Chapter 11. The dragon drug had worn off. Its after effects are not pleasant, combining as they do physical fatigue with a certain starkness of thought, as if all color were drained from the mind. Now clad in a gray dressing gown, Demon lay on a gray couch in his third floor study. His son stood at the window with his back to the silence. In a damask padded room on the second floor, immediately below the study, waited Ada, who had arrived with Vaughn a couple of minutes ago. In the skyscraper across the lane, a window was open exactly opposite the study, and an aproned man stood there, setting up an easel and cocking his head in search of the right angle. The first thing Demon said was, "I insist that you face me when I'm speaking to you." Vaughn realized that the fateful conversation must have already started in his father's brain, for the admonishment had the ring of a self-interruption, and with a slight bow, he took a seat. "However, before I advise you of those two facts, I would like to know how long this has been going on, one presumes, or something equally banal. But then all ends are banal. Hangings, the Nuremberg old maid's iron sting, shooting oneself, last words in the brand new Lador Hospital, mistaking a drop of 30,000 feet for the airplane's washroom, being poisoned by one's wife, expecting a bit of Crimean hospitality, congratulating Mr. and Mrs. Vinelander. It will be 9 years soon," replied Vaughn. "I seduced her in the summer of 1884. Except for a single occasion, we did not make love again until the summer of 1888. After a long separation, we spent one winter together. All in all, I suppose I have had her about 1,000 times. She is my whole life." A longish pause, not unlike a fellow actor's dry-up, came in response to his well-rehearsed speech. Finally, Demon, "The second fact may horrify you even more than the first. I know it caused me much deeper worry, moral, of course, not monetary, than Ada's case, of which eventually her mother informed Cousin Dan, so that, in a sense..." Pause with an underground trickle. "Some other time I'll tell you about the Black Miller. Not now. Too trivial. Dr. Lapinet's wife, born Countess Alp, not only left him in 1871 to live with Norbert von Miller, amateur poet, Russian translator at the Italian consulate in Geneva, and professional smuggler of neonegrine, found only in the Valais, but had imparted to her lover the melodramatic details of the subterfuge which the kind-hearted physician had considered would prove a boon to one lady and a blessing to the other. Versatile Norbert spoke English with an extravagant accent, hugely admired wealthy people, and when name-dropping, always qualified such a person as enormously rich, with awed, amorous gusto, throwing himself back in his chair and spreading tensely curved arms to enfold an invisible fortune. He had a round head as bare as a knee, a corpse's button nose, and very white, very limp, very damp hands adorned with rutilant gems. His mistress soon left him. Dr. Lapinet died in 1872. About the same time, the Baron married an innkeeper's innocent daughter and began to blackmail Demon Veen. This went on for almost 20 years, until aging Miller was shot dead by an Italian policeman on a little-known border trail, which had seemed to get steeper and muddier every year. Out of sheer kindness or habit, Demon bade his lawyer continue to send Miller's widow, who mistook it naively for insurance money, the trimestrial sum which had been swelling with each pregnancy of the robust Swissness. Demon used to say that he would publish one day Black Miller's quatrains, which adorned his letters with the jingle of verselets on calendarial leaves. "My spouse is thicker, I am leaner. Again it comes, a new bambino. You must be good like I am good. Her stove is big and wants more wood." We may add to complete this useful parenthesis that in early February, 1893, not long after the poet's death, two other less successful blackmailers were waiting in the wings. Kim, who would have bothered Ada again had he not been carried out of his cottage with one eye hanging on a red thread and the other drowned in its blood, and the son of one of the former employees of the famous clandestine message agency, after it had been closed by the U.S. government in 1928, when the past had ceased to matter, and nothing but the straw of a prison cell could reward the optimism of second-generation rogues. The most protracted of the several pauses having run its dark course, Damon's voice emerged to say with a vigor that it had lacked before, "Vaughn, you receive the news I impart with incomprehensible calmness. I do not recall any instance, in factual or fictional life, of a father's having to tell his son that particular kind of thing in these particular circumstances. But you play with a pencil and seem as unruffled as if we were discussing your gaming debts or the demands of a wench knocked up in a ditch." Tell him about the herbarium in the attic? About the indiscretions of anonymous servants? About a forged wedding date? About everything that two bright children had so gaily gleaned? I will. He did. "She was 12, Vaughn added, "and I was a male primatal of 14 and a half. And we just did not care. And it's too late to care now."
"Too late?"
shouted his father, sitting up on his couch.
"Please, Dad, do not lose your temper," said Vaughn. "Nature, as I informed you once, has been kind to me. We can afford to be careless in every sense of the word."
"I'm not concerned with semantics or semination. One thing, and only one, matters. It is not too late to stop that ignoble affair."
"No shouting and no Philistine epithets," interrupted Vaughn.
"All right," said Damon. "I take back the adjective and I ask you instead. Is it too late to prevent your affair with your sister from wrecking her life?"
Vaughn knew this was coming. He knew, he said, this was coming. Ignoble had been taken care of. Would his accuser define wrecking? The conversation now took a neutral turn that was far more terrible than its introductory admission of faults for which our young lovers had long pardoned their parents. How did Vaughn imagine his sisters pursuing a scenic career? Would he admit it would be wrecked if they persisted in their relationship? Did he envisage a life of concealment in luxurious exile? Was he ready to deprive her of normal interests and a normal marriage? Children? Normal amusements?
"Don't forget normal adultery," remarked Vaughn. "How much better that would be," said Grim Damon, sitting on the edge of the couch with both elbows propped on his knees and nursing his head in his hands. "The awfulness of the situation is an abyss that grows deeper the more I think of it. You force me to bring up the tritest terms such as family, honor, set, law. All right. I have bribed many officials in my wild life, but neither you nor I can bribe a whole culture, a whole country. And the emotional impact of learning that for almost 10 years, you and that charming child have been deceiving their parents." Here Vaughn expected his father to take the "it would kill your mother" line, but Damon was wise enough to keep clear of it. Nothing could kill Marina. If any rumors of incest did come her way, concern with her inner peace would help her to ignore them, or at least romanticize them out of reality's reach. Both men knew that. Her image appeared for a moment and accomplished a facile fade-out. Damon spoke.
"I cannot disinherit you. Aqua left you enough ridge and real estate to annul the conventional punishment. And I cannot denounce you to the authorities without involving my daughter, whom I mean to protect at all cost. But I can do the next proper thing. I can curse you. I can make this our last...
Vaughn, whose finger had been gliding endlessly to and fro along the mute but soothingly smooth edge of the mahogany desk, now heard with horror,
the sob that shook Daman's entire frame, and then saw a deluge of tears flowing down those hollow, tanned cheeks. In an amateur parody at Van's birthday party 15 years ago, his father had made himself up as Boris Godunov and shed strange, frightening, jet-black tears before rolling down the steps of a burlesque throne in death's total surrender to gravity. Did those dark streaks in the present show come from his blackening his orbits, eyelashes, eyelids, eyebrows? The Funist Gamester, the pale, fatal girl in another well-known melodrama, in this one. Van gave him a clean handkerchief to replace the soiled rag. His own marble calm did not surprise Van. The ridicule of a good cry with father adequately clogged the usual ducts of emotion. Daman regained his composure, if not his young looks, and said, "I believe in you and your common sense. You must not allow an old debaucher to disown an only son. If you love her, you wish her to be happy, and she will not be as happy as she could be once you gave her up. You may go. Tell her to come here on your way down." Down. My first is a vehicle that twists dead daisies around its spokes. My second is old Manhattan slang for money, and my whole makes a hole. As he traversed the second floor landing, he saw, through the archway of two rooms, Ada in her black dress standing with her back to him at the oval window in the boudoir. He told a footman to convey her father's message to her and passed almost at a run through the familiar echoes of the stone-flagged vestibule. My second is also the meeting place of two steep slopes. Right-hand lower drawer of my practically unused new desk, which is quite as big as Dad's, with Sig's compliments. He judged it would take him as much time to find a taxi at this hour of the day as to walk, with his ordinary swift swing, the 10 blocks to Alex Avenue. He was coatless, tieless, hatless. A strong, sharp wind dimmed his sight with salty frost and played Medusian havoc with his black locks. Upon letting himself in for the last time into his idiotically cheerful apartment, he forthwith sat down at that really magnificent desk and wrote the following note. "Do what he tells you. His logic sounds preposterous, presupposing, sick, a vague kind of Victorian era, as they have on Terra, according to my mad, ? But in a paroxysm of, illegible, I suddenly realized he was right. Yes, right, here and there. Not neither here nor there, as most things are. You see, girl, how it is and must be. In the last window we shared, we both saw a man painting. Us. But your second floor level of vision probably prevented your seeing what he wore, what looked like a butcher's apron, badly smeared. Goodbye, girl." Von sealed the letter, found his Thunderbolt pistol in the place he had visualized, introduced one cartridge into the magazine, and translated it into its chamber. Then, standing before a closet mirror, he put the automatic to his head, at the point of the Terrian, and pressed the comfortably concaved trigger. Nothing happened. Or perhaps everything happened. And his destiny simply forked at that instant, as it probably does sometimes at night, especially in a strange bed, at stages of great happiness or great desolation, when we happen to die in our sleep, but continue our normal existence with no perceptible break in the faked serialization on the following neatly prepared morning, with the spurious past discreetly but firmly attached behind. Anyway, what he held in his right hand was no longer a pistol, but a pocket comb which he passed through his hair at the temples. It was too gray by the time that Ada, then in her 30s, said, when they spoke of their voluntary separation, "I would have killed myself too, had I found Rose wailing over your corpse. Seconde pensée sur les bonnes, as your other white bonne used to say in her pretty patois. As to the apron, you are quite right. And what you did not make out was that the artist had about finished a large picture of your meek little palazzo standing between its two giant guards,
perhaps for the cover of a magazine, which rejected that picture. But, you know, there's one thing I regret, she added. Your use of an alpenstock to release a brute's fury. Not yours, not my Vaughn's. I should never have told you about the Lador policeman. You should never have taken him into your confidence, never connived with him to burn those files, and most of Caligano's pine forest. Eto unagitelno. It is humiliating.
Amends have been made, replied Fat Vaughn with a fat man's chuckle. I'm keeping Kim safe and snug in a nice home for disabled professional people, where he gets from me loads of nicely brailled books on new processes in chromophotography. There are other possible forkings and continuations that occur to the dream mind, but these will do.